Welcome to Influential Visions. Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. My name is Nathaniel Schooler, and I am your host today. No matter how many times I hear that woman say this meeting's being recorded, I just cringe. So today I'm joined by Lillian Pearson, PE, and you are a data strategist and CEO of Datamania, and you've actually educated over 1 million workers around AI and data. Is that correct?
That is correct. I would say, though, that that is a major thanks to my partnerships with Wiley in LinkedIn Learning. So I didn't do that on my own for sure, but I was privileged to have the opportunity to help these businesses make
super.
So make that impact.
Super. So today we're going to talk about purpose-driven data and actionable AI. And I know these are your sweet spots, right? And you know, I speak to a lot of people who are in like IIoT, and they're in data and AI and stuff. And like a lot of CEOs, they approach them and they just say, "Hey, can you help me? I need some AI. Like, I want to buy some AI." And they don't know really what they're actually letting themselves in for, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the difficulty around the lack of data literacy in the corporate world, unfortunately. But you can't be a master of all, you know. You can't be expected to know all the details of how finance is operating and how the business units are doing, keeping your eye on the ball within the business, and then be expected to, you know, understand the ins and outs of AI as well. But there is a major need for high-level data literacy across the organization in terms of corporate executives, but also in terms of workers, because workers are like unable to utilize the data to generate value because they don't have the essential just data literacy skills they need. So that's a major loss for organizations who are spending a lot of money, and we're not even talking about AI here, we're just talking about data systems. They're spending a lot of money to house these, to operate and maintain these data systems. And if that data isn't actually being used to generate value by the workers because they don't know how, then it's a major, it's like a bleeding out money. So yeah,
it's a difficult one, because they almost need to sort of start with the end in mind, right? And then kind of work backwards from there. Would you say that? Or do they need to just start with the actual data that they've got already and then work towards something?
Okay, so how I work with my clients, how we do it within my business, is that we, number one, start with the business vision and taking just a good look. What is the business vision? What's the current state in the organization? So what type of technologies do they have? Kind of people, human resources and skill sets do we have? And then looking also at the data resources, what type of data do we want, and putting together just a general idea of what we've got, and then figure out, you know, what is the lowest hanging fruit? What is the next, you know, the next best step to take us closer to our business vision? And the data and technology and innovation, all of that stuff is just a tool to get closer to the business vision.
Yeah.
And that's how it should be. Otherwise, I'm an engineer. I'm a professional engineer. So I know all too well, it's the difference between systems and processes, like system design and process design. So it's very easy to, if you're working an implementation role, to focus so much on the details of the implementation, you lose the big picture, right? So there's got to be assurances in place that that we are, you know, and the assurance is, okay, like the project, the end goal of the project is to support the business vision and to generate profits, really. right? So how do we make sure that happens? How do we steer all of our data projects so that we maintain their profitability? Important. This is important stuff. And I just did a poll. With my audience, and I have an audience of data leaders. So they're amazing and really, really talented and smart. This isn't just a C-level problem or something like that. Also, data people aren't getting trained in the business consulting end of it. So the poll came back that I think it was like 86% of people do. Oh, it was like 83% of data leaders said that they don't know of anyone who's actually measuring like KPIs in how well their data projects are reaching the project goals.
Wow.
So this is data projects, but no measurement in terms of how is this performing against benchmarks and like making sure to have like every quarterly review to make sure we're not losing our, you know.
Of course, you losing the end goal, right? Losing touch with reality. It's so normal in business for people to get stuck within the business, like working on what their day to day is, right? Without working on the outside. So it's the same problem, isn't
yeah.
it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Same
problem. You have to have someone. So in some cases, businesses are far enough along that they have like chief data officer and they have that oversight in place, someone who is accountable, who is the shepherd of all of the data projects. But most organizations aren't at that point, and it's crucial to like to have a plan. That's why I'm in data strategy. So I'm going to say this till the cows come home, but it's crucial to have a plan and then have your KPIs and be evaluating, okay, how are we performing against the plan? Is there any adjustments? You don't get down the road 2 years and find out that you just lost a few million dollars because it was the wrong technology in the first place, you know?
Yeah, completely. I mean,
and that happens.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. I mean, I'm very worried for the businesses that are not investing in the new tech because they are being left behind. Yeah. Like there are all sorts of studies that are just showing that literally the businesses that are leading are the ones that can innovate really fast. They can analyze the data really fast. They listen to the mm-hmm. customer, but the ones that are failing are the ones that aren't keeping up because their costs are now too high, right? They're too far ahead. Some of these companies.
But it's been coming. Like I remember when I wrote Data Science for Dummies. And the first version was back in 2014. And there was a whole chapter on that because it was so obvious. This is what's coming, you know? And so here are some steps you can take. You can either try, and I've always been a proponent of get everyone in the organization, you know, trained at least in some level with data. Don't rely on these unicorns because they're not going to be able to like, no one person can come in, you know, like a really costly data scientist can come in, yes, and they can help on one level, but there's only so much a small group can do. It's part of you got to distribute the skill set and stuff. So like it's been coming a long time. And what is this? This is 6 years later. So now it's happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it wasn't kind of like the coronavirus. If you're watching the news, it's like, well, how could that have been a surprise?
Well, it's exponential, and that's the thing, yeah, with business as well, right? Like the disruption is happening, but now it's so quick that it just happens, you know, and the business dies very quickly, yeah, unfortunately.
It's hard for the big organizations, actually. It's because the processes and the bureaucracy, they're not nimble enough to keep up, so smaller startups can come and, you know, become profitable, and they're very efficient, you know, because they don't have all of that overhead.
Very much
in terms of bureaucracy and function.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, it's I've been doing quite a bit of writing as well around this, and it's just crazy, really, how companies just don't sometimes have a plan. They don't know what they actually want to achieve, and they're kind of a bit lost, I think. So The next thing,
there's no one out there though. Let me tell you, this is one of the big things behind why, like the ethos behind why I'm doing data strategy, beyond the fact that I just am a strategist by nature and all that. But these consultants, these big name consultants that come in to do these sorts of strategic plans and assessments and all of that, you know, they're charging $250,000 a year. Not a year, $250,000 a quarter. So $250,000 a quarter, and coming in with these cookie cutter templates that they come in and then they just fill in, you know, the details from the next business. You know, they just keep going in and like doing the same thing over and over. And it's not even really a custom evaluation. It's almost like, because I've just seen it from the inside, it's almost like 40% sales pitch. That's not helping anyone. And it's like, the skill set, the expertise and the knowledge is tied up behind these huge gates where people need it, but they like the strategic, just an approach, a framework. If you look at data strategy framework in search, everyone and their mother is looking for a data strategy framework, but the big guys that are out there making $250,000 a quarter are not sharing that knowledge, right? I have worked with a lot of organizations. So I have picked up, you know, I picked up my approach from both in working as a technical consultant, as an engineer, doing strategic plans for the Navy, and then working with major organizations, writing books and doing consulting and training. So we developed a framework, but like, that's one of the big things is I want this information to get out there and to, as I mean, it's overplayed the word democratize in the data space because it just is, but it's a perfect term to like get this information. It's vital that organizations start having a framework for managing and measuring and protecting their investments in data so that they can get ahead without the risk, because there's a lot of risk. And if you're charging so much money, you know, a lot of businesses just can't like justify like, oh, we're going to spend $250,000 for a quarter just to get this half-baked thing. And, you know, that's not good for anyone.
Yeah, I agree. I think training the people is definitely the way to go, because then you're going to have a really bespoke, tailored strategy, right? If you train the right people, then they can maintain it, they can roll it out, and they can work together. Because strategy without the people is like, well, what's the point? It's just someone external coming in and kind of beating everyone with a stick and then disappearing, right? Like I get it. Yeah, I do get it. And it's not an easy task for some people, because it's like they've been doing their job in a certain way for a certain amount of years, and then someone comes in with this template and says, but this is how you should be doing it, right?
Yeah, I mean, but a lot of times inside organizations, even when you start doing like skill sets evaluations and looking at how people are structured, sometimes people just need to be moved around because they're actually in a role that isn't good for their background, and they could probably be happier and be a lot more valuable to the organization if they were repositioned, even within the same data space, but in a different function. I mean, yeah, there's a lot to do with people, but there's also a lot to do with technologies and just choosing the most efficient route and trying to keep overhead low and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, you know, and start off with the lowest hanging fruit, like you said in the beginning of our conversation, you know, because to work out specific things that are very, very simple, are gonna save the organization a lot of money, right? And then you have a safer organization, don't you, moving forwards. But we were going to talk about AI ethics in the modern world, because that's a super interesting topic, mm-hmm. especially with kind of this pandemic that we've been going through, and you know how that ties into like data privacy and stuff.
Yeah, actually, you reminded me. I'm doing a project right now with Huawei, and so I've been thinking about a concept, you know, because I also do marketing, and so this is going to be an article on AI ethics, and I like to always have a backstory of how this actually relates to real life. And we're thinking about AI ethics in panic buying and supply chain, food supply. And what about, how does AI ethics tie into supply chain operations and distribution, particularly in places now with the coronavirus, where they're saying that like most of the people that were going hungry before, like the hunger issues have like just dramatically, you know, they have increased a lot. So yeah, sorry, it's got a little distracted, but yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, ethics is a huge deal. And
I mean, I'm actually thinking more along the lines of the ethics of your mobile phone. Yeah. So I think it was Singapore or Taiwan, and they, what they did to shut down the coronavirus is they tracked the mobile mm-hmm. phone movements of the people who were infected, right?
Russia's doing that as well.
Pardon?
Russia's doing that as well, so they have no data privacy. It's to the individual, and then they track who they were around, and they quarantine that way. Right. So it's a data privacy thing. There's AI involved in that, I'm sure, but it's also... AI is such a buzzword, but it's not necessarily all about AI. It could be just ethics, data. I just call it data ethics because it's not even necessarily about the AI, although there does need to be ethical, like accountability in AI as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead. Sorry. They're so passionate about this.
No, topic. Don't worry. Me too. That's why I was kind of like, I just had something else come to mind. You know, it's kind of like, Where do the ethics lead a company? It's like, is it okay to have a company with say you've got 100,000 employees, yeah, and you discover that you can create an AI within 2 years that can remove 50,000 employees, yeah, and then you're going to make more than twice the profit, right? So where do universal ethics, kick in?
That is so outside. We don't talk about this in terms of from a data professional standpoint. We don't really talk about that. That isn't included in the AI ethics suite of consideration. That is like, but I see that's a convenient omission.
Yes.
You have a good point there. But then we're going more into this whole living wage thing and stuff like that, because you can't expect companies to pay more for something they can get done at better quality for cheaper if a machine does it. So that doesn't make any sense, because humans can never even do, like, for the tasks that can be automated, human error is, you know, like there's no person that can be perfect like a machine can. So why would you can't just expect people to pay. That would be like asking an individual, like asking you or I to say, well, you need to pay, you know, more for this bread because you're responsible for the person who makes it, and we don't want to provide it to you a cheaper price and better quality. Like, you can't get cheaper price and better quality because it's a machine generated thing and it's not ethical. Well,
Does it, we
can't get into like politics and all this
does
stuff
it,
here.
Does it not redefine the definition of an organization? The ethics within AI and jobs. So, for example, you could build a business that has a massive revenue, right? And if you don't have shareholders, then you could just create a machine of a business with no people, right? That could make like $1 billion a year. Yeah. So
you mean like Facebook?
Yeah. Right. So, but the good news is that in the UK, we've put this once we get out of the EU, right? Which, mm-hmm. you know, my opinion on that is nothing to do with my comment here. Yeah. Is mm-hmm. that we're going to be charging businesses that make over, I think, 100 million pounds a year. And we're going to take taxes from those. Right. But that should have happened anyway. Yeah. If you're coming into a country's infrastructure and you're taking money out of the infrastructure, you need to pay some money to that country or countries. Right. Like, that's ethics in itself. That's
because it does make sense, because otherwise it's a parasite. If you have a operation that you can then automate and it doesn't actually bring back to the community. It just automates and sucks out from the community, then that becomes a parasite. So that does make sense. And I like that idea of like, you have to pay money back in. I just feel like at a certain point, businesses are in, you know, if it's not profitable, it's not a business, it's a hobby. Businesses are in the game of making money. That's what businesses do. So there is an ethical standard that needs to be upheld. But I think in the long run, this is going to be something where it's going to come down to governments and like some organizations of people that set rules, like you're saying, and say, okay, you have to give back so we can distribute. But there is more, it does seem like there's more chance for tyranny and aggregation of wealth, because if the corporations are required to give the money to the government, that doesn't say that the money is actually going to get distributed to the people, right? The money could just end up offshore somewhere.
Very true. Very true.
So there's like more, even more chance of that. So it's going to, I don't know what the answer will be, but it's tricky, but this is change. If you look at, you know, technology brings change, and, you know, they said the world was flat, and then they said we couldn't go to the moon, and all of these things is always just this, we can't even foresee what's going to happen in the future, but it always ends up okay eventually.
Yeah. Eventually.
I say that as a person, you know, as a person born in, you know, a good family in America, you know, so I don't know if people born in developing countries with less education and less resources would necessarily agree with that. So,
yeah, it's very, very difficult for a lot of people, but sometimes those experiences make them stronger, and then they go out and do amazing things, you know, like, I mean, one of my contacts, you know, he grew up in a very, very tough, tough household in London, in a very poor area. His dad used to drink and beat him and beat his mom when he was like 8 years old. But then he grew a business and sold it for, you know, billions. Yeah. Like over 3 billion. Yeah. So it's like,
yeah, well, it does a lot come down to individualism.
Yeah.
And stuff. But we could go on a whole thing, because I'm very much, I was raised conservative. I'm a capitalist, you know, I'm all these things. I'm very much along the lines of what you're saying here, 100%. However, I did read an article today about the coronavirus and about how it was causing deaths in a staggering rate among African Americans. And it's not necessarily the poor ones. It's also people that have middle income. So it's a cultural thing, like the health culture or something. And then you start seeing, and the article really helped me to understand that, like, it said something about you think that there's individualism, you know, there's equal options and opportunities for success when you're privileged, but when you come from poverty, the poverty takes all those choices away. And just seeing the evidence, the data on how African Americans are really suffering, not in the same way as other ethnic groups. You know, I understood, you know, that hit home. I understood. It wasn't just like, oh, white privilege or something, which people say. I understood that this is something that's very real and very sad that needs to be addressed. It's not
very
fair.
Much. It's very sad. And I've been nodding for people who are listening to this and they can't see the video. You know, I'm nodding away at that, because it is like, you're right, the white privilege like to think that, but actually when you're poor and you're in that particular place, like, yeah, there are good stories, but for the majority of people, life's pretty grim. Let's be fair. And, you know, I'm very worried about Africa at the moment, India, Bangladesh, Cambodia, you know, all these regions, right? Because
Thailand.
Yeah, of course, because
we're okay over here, actually.
But what's that?
We're okay over here.
Yeah, but it's not about you guys actually catching the coronavirus, right? It's actually about, for one example, retailers not making orders for clothes. Yeah, so the workers who would in essence make those clothes, yeah, are now out of work. Yeah. So, and they're the poorest people. So they're going to have to go back to the villages in the sticks where they've come from. And then, yes, they're going to spread the virus.
Oh, that's happened here.
I know.
People, because there's no tourism. So people went back. They had to go back. And there's no way for them to get money. They're not allowed to work. And like, even so, we're not allowed to leave our house. So how can they make any money? And there's overcrowding. I mean, it's happening where I live, but I'm not seeing it so much because we have a nanny and we kind of support them and they support us, actually, their family. Yeah. We're kind of help each other. But other than that, I don't see, you know, but it is very, very hard. But I think people come together.
Yes. And it will
share and they're going to, it's just, well, these people are good. They will come together.
Let's hope so. I mean, I've certainly seen evidence of people are a lot more friendly when I bump into them outside now. The way of life has kind of slowed down in Sussex. You know, when people have a walk once a day, which is what we're allowed one walk a day, and you know, you can go to the supermarket or the gas station, and that's about it, right? But I've seen more. Sort of a more humanity, really, I think, from what's going on. I think, you know, but time will tell. I'm still very, very worried about the implications. However, the positive side of it is that, you know, we've rapidly changed the way that we run the health service here. So some of the things that we're doing, you know, for example, online video interviews with patients, we're analyzing data more for like with images, right, of like disease, so there are all sorts of these things that are super, super amazing, and they're becoming more known, aren't they? So that's quite exciting.
It's part of like they've had this thing going on for a long time online, the future of work, you know, but I feel like this is going to be the impetus to really push organizations into that future, because they're going to, I mean, it's hard at first. In this survey, you know, I've been in touch with my list, my email list, and, you know, it's been hard for people to transition their teams to 100% remotely, but they're doing it. And once you figure out how to do well and remotely, then you don't have to worry about all the overhead with the buildings and the commuting and the all of the things. It's like a real what's a happiness index. I mean, people would be so much happier if they didn't have to spend 2 hours on the road commuting and these things that they used to be necessary. Businesses, you know, people used to need to go in and work and they used to need to have a building and all this stuff. But I mean, it's been a long time now. You know, I've been here 6 years operating a business 100% remotely. It's been a long time now where this has been an option, but people, organizations haven't taken it. But now it's like, this is kind of at least one thing that may come out of this whole pandemic that is like, eventually there's going to be some really good things. Eventually it will be like, we'll see something on the other side. They'd be like, wow, it's always that way. There's this amazing outcome, but that would not have been possible if we had not been pushed through the suffering.
Definitely. Definitely. I think there's a lot of positive things that are going to come, but right now we're in England, we're at a bad place right now. We're just about to, you know, go into what, the second week in April, and you know, we had our most amount of deaths, I think, the other day, which was, you know, I think it was a couple of days, but it was awful. And I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, really, I'm afraid. But I just hope that the people with brains actually stay inside. Unfortunately, you get the rule breakers who think that they're a bit more important than everyone else, right? And they're the ones that are a worry in my mind.
Yeah, it's tough. It's so tough being stuck inside all this time. I can't believe we're even having this conversation. Can you?
No.
But if we look at the statistics, statistically speaking, it's kind of like a 100-year flood. We should have been prepared and everyone should have expected this. Like Bill Gates, you know, it's like, oh yeah, he was talking about it. But if you studied hydrology because I'm an environmental engineer. Like if you look at the statistics, this was coming.
Yeah.
It's going to come again next 100 years, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So how Would you support the business to reach goals with data and AI?
Well, you have to look at, going back, I'm always going to go back to the very, very beginning, which is you have got to look at the business vision and the organization in its current state. And then look at use cases and case studies and evaluate them to identify which of them is the optimal pathway, which is going to get the business closest to closer to its vision, to reaching its goals, to generating profit with the least amount of expenditures and the least amount of risk in the shortest amount of time. So there's a pretty, you know, there's, you could, you know, there's a lot of factors to consider in that. So I say a big part of it is the use case evaluation and the current state evaluation and matching up the current state against the use cases and the options. Once you have solidified what use case you're after, then it comes down to making it happen. So evaluating technology alternatives in order to make sure that you're making the technology selections that are appropriate and aren't gonna put financial risk in the organization or a lot of maintenance and operation costs. You're gonna do an alternatives analysis and then evaluate the organization in terms of its skill sets. It's gonna need training, culture, all of, you know, and evaluate where the organization is at and what changes need to be made in order to reach the goals and come up with a roadmap, make a recommendations of, okay, these are the changes that need to be made and here is the roadmap and timelines. Here are the dependencies along this roadmap and here are, you know, set your metrics, set your KPIs. Here are the handlebars that we know, okay, this is working and this is not working, so that we can keep an eye on the price throughout the transition. And then just take it one step at a time or multiple steps at a time. But everything is planned and measured and should be operating, you know, within reason. The plan should go as anticipated. If not, there, you know, that is good to have in mind that, okay, we say in this quarter, something's going wrong here. Do we need to reevaluate? Do we need to tweak our plan? What do we need to do to make sure that we stay on target? And then another, so what we do in Data Mania is we actually create strategic plans, living, breathing documents that need to be updated every 18 to 24 months in this case, because technology moves quickly. But yeah, like a low hanging fruit use case would be something like you can generate profits from something, or when I say profits, I don't just mean more sales. Maybe that's operational efficiencies, or maybe it's new revenue streams from data sources they already own. So when I say profits, it's, you know, there's a lot of ways to form profits in a business, but, you know, if you can get a project up and running and forming new, improved profits in 8 weeks, that sounds like a low hanging fruit use case. You want to go for that one first, and then you can kind of scale it up and ramp it out once you've had success with one use case, you know, but no, organizational leaders, they're not going to, and they shouldn't buy into bigger projects or longer scope projects without having that initial success, because it's just too much risk for the business. And you can ask the now defunct Hadoop vendors that are no longer getting business because people invested without, and it was just too long and drawn out and the profits never actually came, you know, so no one's going to buy into that and they shouldn't. Yeah. So we got to get the quick win. So I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, completely. So would you say like maybe launching like a customer service chatbot or, you know, I know this is an old solution, but still many businesses haven't done this, right? So would that fit like a good case for use?
Chatbots could, if you were looking at a marketing If you're looking to make marketing improvements, chatbots is one type of technology that can do that. I'm sorry, my phone. But whatever it is, you have to just back up first and look at the business vision and where the organization is at and what is going to be the biggest bang for its buck immediately.
Oh, I just lost my glasses. It was a fly.
Oh, gosh. In your serene...
The first for me, I went like this and swatted a fly and knocked my glasses off. But it's okay. I can see.
Okay. Yeah, computer glasses. Mine are computer glasses as well.
It's good though, because it stops the glare, doesn't it, on the screen, right?
Yeah, it actually, I believe it does.
Yeah.
I believe in these. Yeah, so it just depends. So yeah, a chatbot would be one type of use case. But I wouldn't necessarily say, okay, well, everyone's getting chatbots, so I should get a chatbot, because there may be something else that would be a lot easier for your business to implement and a lot more profitable, a lot better returns for, you know, the investment. So that's why it's good to just take a few minutes, take the roadmap that we have in, that I share in my business with my clients is a 70-day roadmap. So take the 70 days. But when I do the plan myself, it's like, take the 4 to 6 weeks to do a plan before making the choice to protect the bottom line, basically.
Super. But you're giving away, you're selling, there's like a course that you're just about to launch, right? Is that, we can drop the link somewhere for that when it's ready or?
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, it is ready, but right now we have the VIP list. So it's, everything is redirecting to the VIP list, and people who are on the VIP list then get the first 20 people to join this membership will get a free copy of my book, Data Science for Dummies. So, the program is going to be open. It's not really a program. It's a data strategy product. So it's a series. It's a suite of tools, and they're self-service tools, and also some training videos on how to use them in order to build a data strategy for your organization. So you don't have to spend $250,000 for someone to come in and sell you what they sold the last guy.
Super. Well, that sounds fantastic. I'll certainly drop a link there. And you've been very generous with your time and knowledge. It's been super.
Thank you for having me on. It's been great. Thank you, Nathaniel.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections too. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thank you.